Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The world's first permanent international criminal court became a reality today. Ratified by 74 nations, the ICC claims jurisdiction over everyone, from presidents to private citizens. No one is exempt from war crimes prosecution, except Americans, or so says the Bush administration. The U.S. has fought vigorously against inclusion in the ICC and threatened to withdraw from all U.N. peacekeeping missions if U.S. nationals, specifically U.S. soldiers, aren't put outside the court's jurisdiction. Last night, the Bush administration made good on its threat in a pro forma vote at the Security Council extending the UN's mission to Bosnia for another 6 months. The U.S. vetoed the measure. International reaction to the veto was swift, including this comment from former UN Special Representative to the Balkans, Carl Bildt.
If it is carried through, it would mean the end of virtually all of the peace operations that are there in the Balkans.
All that for the 46 Americans currently serving in the United Nations 1,500-man police force in Bosnia. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N., John Negroponte, said he vetoed the resolution with great reluctance, but the United States would pull out of any U.N. peacekeeping mission where its soldiers fell under the jurisdiction of the ICC. And I'm told the two American soldiers in the U.N.'s East Timor mission were removed today. Earlier, I spoke with Peter Ford, chief European correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked him to describe Europe's reaction to the American veto.
Dismay, really. There have been quite a lot of negotiations over the course of several weeks between the United States and other members of the Security Council to try and sort this problem out. But it hasn't proved possible to find any common ground. And I don't think European diplomats really understand quite why the United States is as opposed as it is to the creation of the court.
Is there a sense of surprise? Did people think that this was actually some kind of rhetoric from a conservative administration, but in the end, you know, this was a no-brainer and of course, the Bosnia mission would continue?
Yes. I mean, I don't think anybody expected the United States to take it to this point. Everybody has known for a long time that the United States doesn't like the ICC, and particularly the Bush administration is very strongly opposed to it. I don't think, though, that when push came to shove, anybody thought that Washington would actually endanger something like the peacekeeping mission in the Balkans over the issue.
So which countries have been most vociferous in expressing their anger about this?
Well, throughout the negotiations, the people who've taken the lead in it have been European countries, because they are, on the one hand, United States allies and countries that the United States can trust, and on the other, very strong proponents of the court. They started by trying to explain their position to the United States that really the likelihood of any U.S. soldier, or indeed of any United Nations personnel, ever being charged during a peacekeeping tour of duty with the sorts of crimes that the ICC will deal with. I mean, we're talking about genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes. I mean, absolutely the most horrendous things. The chances that any UN personnel will be charged with those sorts of things are minimal. No. And secondly, that were anybody to be charged, I mean, were any U.S. soldier to be charged with such a crime, he would never come up before the ICC unless the United States itself refused to investigate or take jurisdiction over the case, which itself is almost impossible.
Do you get the sense that the American diplomats from an earlier administration who were involved in actually the early discussions about forming the ICC, I mean, President Clinton put his signature on the treaty creating the tribunal. Is there some sense of dismay of those who are still working in Europe that there's been this backtracking?
Well, President Clinton did sign it, but only at the very last minute. He had to sign it in order to keep America's options open. The United States, even during the negotiations in Rome in 1998, were not happy with some of the provisions of the treaty, and Washington has never been a great supporter of the idea, and President Clinton signed it but recommended to his successor that it not be passed to the Senate for ratification. I think, though, there is a certain disquiet amongst some American diplomats because the main driving force behind the opposition to the court seems to be coming more from the Pentagon than anywhere else.
Let's assume that, for the sake of argument, that no compromise is reached. Are European governments already thinking about a plan B in order to continue some kind of peacekeeping mission in Bosnia?
Well, it's not quite as bad as all that, because what we're talking about in this specific case is a police training mission that the United Nations runs in Bosnia, not the overall NATO peacekeeping force. The NATO peacekeeping force can operate even without United Nations authorization, although some members, such as Germany, would be happier with UN mandate. But NATO will continue to be there. The vast bulk of the troops will stay there. The police training program could conceivably continue under European auspices. The plan has always been that at the end of the year, the UN would hand over to the European Union in this particular field. It may be that European nations could get their skates on and take it over before the end of the year, but it's most unlikely they could do that in the next 3 or 4 days.
So what we're looking at, say, in 72 hours, should the situation remain unchanged, is what?
Well, we're looking at the end of the UN police program in Bosnia. We're looking at the possibility of the United States troops pulling out of the NATO force there and elsewhere, because what the United States is looking for is not just an exemption from its peacekeepers in United Nations missions, but it's an exemption in all peacekeeping missions. Now, if that were to spread to Kosovo, for example, then we'd be talking about a very serious withdrawal. I think what they'll be working out of the United Nations very hard over the next 3 days is some form of words that will save some face and keep these things alive, because I don't think anybody wants to see every peacekeeping operation in the Balkans and elsewhere in the world collapse because of this.
Mm. So it is about face at the moment, isn't it? It's about somehow diplomats from both sides of the Atlantic figuring out how the administration can, having made this extraordinarily bold, aggressive decision, have some face and still be part of international peacekeeping.
I think it has to be about face, because it's become clear that there is absolutely no way that on the substantive issues any common ground could be found.
Peter Ford, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Peter Ford is chief European correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and he spoke with us from Paris. We're talking tonight on Point Listeners about American opposition to the International Criminal Court and the specifics of today's news, the United States' veto of a 6-month extension of UN peacekeeping mission in Bosnia. Is America protecting its troops or jeopardizing global peace by taking such a hard line on the jurisdiction of the ICC? Should the U.S. exempt itself from a World War Crimes Court? And if the U.S. isn't a participant, what value can the court have? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Jack Spencer, defense and national security policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Good evening, Jack Spencer.
Hello.
And also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point's news analyst, Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack. I hope you're there, Jack.
Michael, hello.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll be two Jacks, I believe.
Yes, Jack and Jack. So but we have... What should we say? We have Heritage Department, Jack. We have Atlantic Monthly Magazine, Jack. And that's how we'll distinguish you tonight. Heritage Foundation, Jack, first. We were just talking at the very end with Peter Ford about saving face and so on. I mean, it does seem rather extraordinary for the Bush administration to take its particular feelings about the ICC to such an extreme as to jeopardize, first of all, what's a fairly important police training mission in Bosnia. I mean, it's mandated in the Dayton Agreement. It's 7 years since that was signed. It's important to help the Bosnians get their own police force together. Why jeopardize that for this?
Well, I think that it's about much more than just face. And I think that whenever you start saying, putting it in the context or in the frame of the Bush administration being extreme and hardline and aggressive, the same can be said about the United Nations and those who support this. They also are not willing to compromise very much. I think what we need to look at here is the true question that we're asking. The question is, who is the ultimate authority of the world's citizens? Is it the nation state, which has traditionally been the case, or is it some supranational power, which in Europe and in some other places, but primarily in Europe, that seems to be the feeling there? And that's what this debate's about. It's about far more than just the International Criminal Court, and it's about far more, far more than just about saving face. I just wanted to say that up front.
Okay.
And if I can just take it a step further, what we're looking at here truly is whether or not we support a judicial system based on democratic values or not. I would argue, and I think it's true that the ICC, as it's set up right now, is not based on democratic values. It's not based on the same judicial standards that we have here in the United States. For example, you're not allowed to face your accusers in the ICC. There's no juries at the ICC. Those who are the judges there do not answer to those whom stand before them. Only 74 countries have signed the treaty and ratified it. That's about one-sixth. If you add up the people there, that's about one-sixth of the world population. So to argue that this court claims to be democratic, claims to be a court of the globe, it's not true.
Jack, let me just try to unpick some of that.
Sure.
When you say supranational, does that mean that an organization like the United Nations, it's a supranational organization, is it not?
That's right.
Since 1945, since the end of the Second World War, any number of international bodies have been put together in which nations give up a certain amount of authority to a larger body that is responsive to them, and they are responsive to their citizens, presumably.
True.
So when you say supranational, I mean, I'm just a little confused about that one, because, I mean, how, without getting into the details of the court, right, in some countries,
right.
There is no trial by jury,
these are
not undemocratic countries. France is not an undemocratic country.
The court maintains it has jurisdiction over countries and over country citizens who have not signed on to be part of the court. That is a departure from traditional international law, far different than anything else, and that's what makes that, the International Criminal Court, far different than the United Nations or any other international organization. Traditionally, international organizations have been a mechanism for which nations to govern themselves, to facilitate cooperative efforts to attain goals that are shared amongst many nations. The ICC goes far beyond that by claiming jurisdiction over people who do not sign up to that court. That is very undemocratic.
How would you then deal with, how do you view then the International War Crimes Tribunal for the Balkans? Slobodan Milosevic before it.
It's a farce, actually. Mr. Milosevic sits in front of the court and makes fun of everyone day in and day out. You have, a handful.
Might it be less of a farce if we knew that, first of all, the United States was four square behind the ICC and that there was a movement? We're talking about the beginnings, I think, of a movement towards setting up an international tribunal to deal with a very specific kind of crime.
That's true, but we've had tribunals in the past, and it's not as if we have these monstrous dictators who, the Pol Pots, the Slobodan Milosevic's, the Nazis, these people who have done these things. There are individual tribunals that are set up to deal with those individual situations, regardless of their effectiveness, which, by the way, has been virtually nil, with the exception of the Nuremberg trials. The fact of the matter, people act like this, the ICC is going to solve all the world's problems. The fact of the matter is, international tribunals have never deterred any of these from happening and have been very unsuccessful in actuality.
Jack, we're going to pick you up on all these points, but I'm going to turn to Atlantic Monthly, Jack Beattie. Jack, do you want to quickly respond to what Jack Spencer has been saying?
Well, I don't know that this would have happened if Colin Powell were still alive. This is clearly an embarrassment and a difficult thing for the State Department to have to carry forward because, of course, it's one of any number of U.S. unilateralisms. The very thing that Jack Spencer was signaling out as a fault of this, namely that it was supranational, seems to me to be the positive principle that it embodies. You can't, this court is saying, lock crimes away in the nation state. That won't do anymore. We're one world, and people who are guilty of war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, wars of aggression, people like Saddam Hussein should not be able to hide behind sovereignty as Milosevic did in the Balkans. And, Nuremberg and The Hague, these were ad hoc courts, and they smack of the charge of victor's justice. Well, this would sort of institutionalize a Nuremberg and say, well, no, we're not going to have victor's justice. This is what the world agrees on. And it seems to me that principle is something that would actually help the United States.
If I can just interrupt, I'm sorry.
Quickly, Jack.
But it's not what the world agrees on. That's the lie in all this. I'm not saying that Jack from Atlantic Monthly is lying. But the lie about this is that it's global justice, and it is not. Not a majority of the countries have signed and ratified the treaty.
Jack Spencer, I do have to interrupt you now. We're going to come back to you after the break. We're talking about the International Criminal Court, which came into existence last night. We're talking with Jack Spencer in Washington, Jack Beatty in Vermont, and after the break with Samantha Power. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. You're listening to On Point. Our subject in this hour is the International Criminal Court, which came into existence at midnight last night. We're talking about the International Criminal Court with Jack Spencer, Defense and National Security Policy Analyst at the Heritage Foundation, and with Jack Beatty, our On Point News Analyst. And I'm going to bring into the conversation now Samantha Power, who's a lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. But more importantly, and more apposite for this particular conversation, she's the author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. Samantha, we were listening to Jack Spencer in that first segment, and I think you want to just pick up a few points with him.
Well, one of the charges that was lodged was that the tribunals that exist today, the ad hoc tribunals, which were set up by the Security Council, without the consent, it must be said, of either the Rwandan government or the Serbian government. So these are also undemocratic institutions. But the claim was made that they were a farce. And I would just like to respond to that if I could, because I think they actually embody, very much in a nascent stage right now, but what the International Criminal Court might be able to achieve if it is given teeth over time. The tribunals are imperfect. I'm actually quite a vocal critic of the tribunals. I don't think they pay enough attention to the places in whose name justice is being done. That is, they don't broadcast their proceedings back to the former Yugoslavia or back to Rwanda. They're a little inattentive to the victims, again, who've been so brutalized in Rwanda. 800,000 people were murdered in the former Yugoslavia, 200,000. But what they do extremely well and extremely importantly for U.S. interests is they incapacitate people who are destabilizing the region. The Balkans would look very, very different today if Milosevic and all of his cronies, there are now more than 50 war criminals or alleged war criminals in custody in The Hague. I can tell you it would look so different if those people were still running the show, which is what they would be doing if history was any precedent. That is, I mean, in the past, again, with Nuremberg and Tokyo as the exception, if you commit genocide, if you commit crimes against humanity, you end up usually winning and staying in power, and you get to write the history books. And so you have refugees and victims who are aggrieved and who are waiting for their day to settle old scores. I think that what you see, not only is there a capacity for deterrence in these tribunals, and Jack said that there's no hope for deterrence and that they haven't deterred, I don't think you can test whether they can deter. I don't think you can ever test deterrence, of course, but certainly you can't test it because the tribunals weren't in place before these genocides were undertaken. They can deter. They are good for retribution, for victims to feel like they're acknowledged. They build a historical record. And most crucially, and I come back to it again and again, incapacitation. People who would be undermining stability in the Balkans, perhaps even, Bosnia could easily be a sort of breeding ground for fundamentalism. Bin Laden, I need to remind you, did travel on a Bosnian passport in the 1990s while we allowed the people there to suffer, the Muslims there, to be abused. And I think that what you would see if you weren't able to get rid of these noxious elements is a recurrence, again, of the sort of failed state. Bosnia has a chance now, and it has a chance because of this court and because of U.S. troops and NATO troops who are present there.
Now, Samantha, you said this was a nascent thing, this ICC. I mean, we're only just building law, this kind of international law. Now, the U.S., speaking of nascent, was actually kind of instrumental in getting it started, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the extraordinary things I was able to document in the book is the leadership of the United States across time, whether in Nuremberg or in Tokyo, which was a more imperfect tribunal even than Nuremberg, or in the creation of these two ad hoc courts, one for the former Yugoslavia, one for Rwanda. It was the United States that was very much at the lead, not surprisingly. In the 1990s, if anything was ever to get done, it was with the United States at the lead. The U.S. was also the lead drafter of something called the Genocide Convention, which was the first ever international human rights treaty, which was passed back in 1948. And the U.S. took the lead and it said, you know, we're saying never again and we're putting it in law and we're committing ourselves to prosecute people who commit genocide. What's extraordinary about the 40 years that then followed is very much mapping the concerns of U.S. citizens and certainly U.S. military personnel today is that the U.S. Senate refused to ratify the Genocide Convention. It was just like the Rome Treaty. Back then, though, the fear was that U.S. senators who presided over states that had segregation or where lynchings took place, but that they would be hauled into a distant court with no jury on genocide charges. And you actually had U.S. senators, Southern senators, standing up and saying, we don't want to ratify this Genocide Convention because Jim Crow laws might lead us to be accused of genocide unjustly. And what happened, though, over the course of the last 4 or 5 decades is that the U.S. watched. They looked to see the extent to which the Genocide Convention was misapplied. And certainly we know that the word genocide is tossed around frivolously in certain cases. But what didn't happen is the International Court of Justice was not used as a place for states to bring, you know, the United States up on genocide charges. And the U.S. eventually, in the mid-'80s, more for political reasons than for, you know, sort of long-term systemic interests in justice, did ratify the convention and is now a party to it. And in the 1990s, when the wars in the former Yugoslavia took place, because of the echoes of the Holocaust, seeing those skinny men behind barbed wire, but the U.S. took the lead in setting up the court.
Jack Spencer at the Heritage Foundation, this is a very specific instance, this genocide treaty example that Samantha has just given us. And in fact, I mean, from what we can gather, the real problem the Bush administration has with this treaty is something that's specific, which is the theoretical possibility that an American serviceman serving in Bosnia might, at some point in the future, for political reasons, find himself having to defend himself against a charge of crimes against humanity.
Well, I think that to narrow it to only that reason is to not look at the full context of the issue. There are a number of reasons why the Bush administration is opposed to the treaty. That is one. But there are also many others, the undemocratic aspects of it that I described earlier. Now, I don't disagree, actually. I think there is a place for international tribunals. I think there is a place for this sort of thing to happen. And when I called that a farce earlier, I was talking not that we shouldn't have these things, but they need to be done better. And I simply am not of the feeling that the way the ICC is moving forward is in the United States' best interest and is the proper way to move forward. And that's the bottom line. I think that by saying that the Bush administration or those who don't support the ICC is no longer taking the lead or is no longer doesn't support, you know, bringing genocidal figures to justice, that's not really the truth. The fact of the matter is that's just not the vehicle through which justice should be brought at this point, at least not as it's envisioned currently.
Jack, I want to bring some of our listeners into the conversation, and you can join the conversation, especially those of you at Wisconsin Public Radio, first time with us. Welcome. Call 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Imran is on the line.
Hi. You know, I was just wondering if the U.S. ends up shooting itself in the foot in the process, because on the one hand, it's withdrawing from the ICC, and then sometime in the future, if it turns out there's, you know, God forbid, an action that requires a global response where we want to take the leadership, you know, do we end up losing credibility in the world stage?
Jack Spencer, does this affect U.S. credibility on the world stage?
No, I really don't think that it does. I think that, first of all, we didn't withdraw from the ICC. We were never a party to the ICC. And secondly, this is a developing, an evolutionary thing. Global justice is something that continues to evolve, and this is only one. The United States has taken its leadership role in defending the sovereignty of the nation state. That this whole debate is more about who has ultimate authority over the world's citizens. Is it the nation state? Is it something other than that? And the United States has one particular view. Some other countries have another particular view. And that's really what this debate's about. I don't think that... It might take away our credibility in the short run in the eyes of some European countries who have a more left-leaning, pro-UN leadership right
Jack,
now.
Jack, come on. Jacques Chirac is a Gaullist. That means he's of the right. The French right can be fairly national. In fact, in many ways, you'd probably have much to discuss and enjoy with Jacques Chirac. Don't cheapen the debate by saying that the European right is more left. Right, left anymore doesn't really mean that much.
I wouldn't say that I'm the one cheapening the debate whenever I bring it down to
it isn't
about saving face. Whenever it's brought down to this is about a single issue, it's far bigger than that. It's not just about saving face.
Don't accuse me
of cheapening the debate.
Well, the critical issue here is I think, that, you know, we're talking about our oldest closest since the end of the Second World War allies,
right,
who are actually very, very disappointed, not just, I mean, the ICC, leave aside the ICC, but that is that there would be brinkmanship at the UN and the Security Council. That's what today's news is. And I think that's the question that Imran is
saying. Why are we not allowed to be right? Why can't the United States be right about this issue? And why can we not be disappointed in France's inability to stand up for the rights of the sovereign nation? Why is it always put in the context of the United States being the unilateralist, the United States doing the wrong thing, being the aggressor? That's not the case. We're not being unilateralist. We are standing up for what we believe is in our interest, and we're not doing it unilaterally. It's done throughout all levels of diplomatic channels. Unilateralism is when a country just acts on its own without regard to anyone else. That's not been the case with any of the actions that this administration has been accused of acting unilaterally on, and this is another example of that.
Samantha?
I just would like to get in and just note that that Jack is right in one regard, and that is that there is nothing especially novel about what the Bush administration is doing now. The United States, because of its splendid isolation through time and because of its sovereignty concerns and its desire to exempt itself from international frameworks, has long practiced what has become known as American exceptionalism. Part of the thinking in American exceptionalism is that the United States is an exceptional country, that it actually doesn't commit these crimes, and therefore if anybody were to accuse it of genocide or crimes against humanity or systematic war crimes, that they would necessarily be politically motivated or, you know, interested in just sort of heckling the United States from afar. And this exceptionalism, again, has a long tradition. The United States has been very reluctant. I mentioned the Genocide Convention, but there are also the Landmines Treaty, the Convention on to Eliminate Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on the Rights of the Child. It's always been very reluctant to embed itself in international frameworks where it has to give up some control and defer to some kind of international standard. But the thing that I would strongly disagree with is the idea that there's no cost to doing this. I think especially now, as we actually need our allies, we're not behaving as though we need our European allies, but even if we're not using them in fighting the war in Afghanistan to the extent that they might have expected we would, many people thought that this would be a NATO operation because it was an attack on a NATO country. We decided to go it alone because of the Kosovo intervention. We learned that we didn't like making war by committee, so we're basically doing it going alone, and we have allies participating on our terms rather than theirs. But there's a real sense in Europe, I think, that at a law enforcement level, that the United States does need allied cooperation, and there's a revulsion, I think, not only at the unsigning of the International Criminal Court, which was deemed to be a regression, the claim that the Vienna Convention on treaty adherence was no longer valid, Kyoto, the Chemical Weapons Protocol. I mean, the list goes on in terms of the examples in which American exceptionalism has become American exemptionism in this administration. But the Europeans sort of feel, you know, they come to us when they need us. And they will never give anything away, they being we, the United States, will never give anything away or sacrifice anything in the way of sovereignty in service of investing in an international order. And you talked about short-term and long-term, Jack. The reality is it is a short-term concern now that is inhibiting the United States in relationship to this International Criminal Court. If it was thinking long-term, it would think about working with the court to continue to shape its provisions, to continue to guarantee American due process.
I think that is what's happening. We are continuing to work with the court. The United States is more involved internationally than any other country. The United States
on its terms. The reality is the Europeans now feel like NATO has become the equivalent of the OSCE, a meaningless diplomatic organization that existed for 50 years, that is a military body. It has now atrophied beyond utility.
Countries in general take part in international relations on their terms. And that's just the fact of the matter. And it happens to be in Europe's interest right now, from their perspective, to move forward with these things. They wouldn't do that if they didn't think it was in their interest and on their terms. That's what this debate's all about.
Thank you, Jack. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Kevin is on the line.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you fine, Kevin.
Excellent. Hi, I just wanted to call in and let you all know I've been listening to this on and off throughout the afternoon, different radio stations, and I kind of feel a little bit of what I think Jack is mentioning. I've been a military officer for 15 years, and I'm trained by the United Nations to command United Nations peacekeeping operations. And I know that there's a lot of times where our laws and their laws, or not their laws, but the laws of the international community in general, don't necessarily coincide. What I haven't heard anybody really approach in this particular conversation is whether or not the ICC is modeling its judicial model under or as the United States has our judicial model. And I would feel probably a little bit better as a soldier who's out serving internationally if I knew that the ICC would respect the rights of the accused, as we have rights here in the United States.
Samantha Power.
Well, there are differences in the procedures that have been put in place at the International Criminal Court, and you can see those differences played out in the Milosevic trial or in the trials in Tanzania, where the leading perpetrators of the Rwandan genocide are being prosecuted every day. It is a hybrid of the kind of European continental jurisprudential tradition and ours. One thing I want to stress, though, and you've probably heard this on the other programs, is that the United States doesn't have to send its soldiers, even if in the unlikely event that a U.S. soldier were to meet the very, very high threshold that has been put in place at the International Criminal Court. The three crimes now that can be prosecuted: genocide, systematic and widespread crimes against humanity, so not an isolated crime against humanity, or war crimes as part of a planned sort of war crimes campaign. If a U.S. soldier were alleged to have met one of those standards, the U.S. has it in its capacity, all it has to do to avoid sending its soldier to the U.S., to the International Criminal Court, would be to conduct a good-faith investigation. Now, it's true that it'll be the judges at the International Criminal Court, but I can tell you that they are going to be eminent judges from around the world, that the United States will have a loud say in deciding who will sit on the bench. It'll be the judges to decide whether the U.S. investigation was good faith. But if the U.S., and you know as being a U.S. military officer, how scrupulous the investigative systems are within the U.S. military and the attentiveness to the Geneva Conventions. I mean, I think this is something that would surprise the public and certainly came to surprise me as I research the book, but is the extent to which lawyers are involved in just about every targeting decision that U.S. forces make, and to the extent we saw today, there was an event in Afghanistan where a number of civilians, it looks like, were killed in an attack on a wedding. Well, the first thing the U.S. military does, it sends a team in to do an investigation. Now, if this investigation is a good faith investigation, if they find that there wasn't willful intent to attack a wedding, which is hard to believe that there was an intent to do that, then the likelihood is that you will not, by any stretch of the imagination, meet the ICC's yep. threshold. And so I think even though it is a hybrid and it is, you know, a little more like the European criminal justice system than the American system, you can keep control of your own jurisprudence by doing an investigation yourself. And if it does meet the standard, doing the prosecution at home. The ICC, the International Criminal Court, will only kick in if the U.S. fails to investigate its own potential war crimes.
Jack Spencer.
Well, there are a couple of issues that I'm worried about beyond that, and I think that what was just described is true, but I think that there can be this situation where it is used for political purposes. But one of the things that I think we might have to address with this are issues like the use of depleted uranium or the use of landmines. These are politically hot issues that the United States supports, and much of the same.
Are they systematic crimes against? Are they systematic crimes against humanity? Are they genocide?
No,
are they war
that's
crimes?
That's my point. My fear is that this will be played out before the court. That there will be endless investigations brought up. This is just one of the issues. But the other one, as I pointed out earlier, is that this court is claiming jurisdiction over countries who are not party to the treaty. That is a far departure from from traditional international law, and it's very undemocratic.
Jack Spencer, thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us. Defense and National Security Policy Analyst at the Heritage Foundation.
Thank you.
Jack Spencer was with us. Samantha Power, stay right there. Samantha Power is the author of A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide. Will join us after the break. Jack Beatty will be back. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking about the International Criminal Court, which came into existence at midnight, the United States not being part of it, and its fairly aggressive actions at the UN in the last 24 hours. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in. Samantha Power, who's a public policy analyst at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, is with me in the studio. She's also the author of A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide. And at a studio at Vermont Public Radio is our analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor of The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, you were listening to some of the specifics being discussed just before the break. What do you think?
Well, I'd like to answer Kevin, our officer who called. You know, he was bringing up the point of what about a serviceman like him? I have the feeling that this is not so much about U.S. servicemen as about U.S. policymakers. and that the ghost of, well, he's still alive, but the shade of Henry Kissinger hangs heavy over this. And if you put the thought that someone like Kissinger, in other words, our laws won't hold him, can't hold him indictable for anything he did, but perhaps a court like this could, because we make no good faith effort to investigate, you see. And when you connect that with President Bush's policy of preemptive strikes, this court would, one of the things in its jurisdiction would be to would be wars of aggression. Well, you see that Dom Rumsfeld could look at this and think, well, if we unleash a war that someone thinks is a war of aggression, and we make no good faith effort to investigate it because it's not a crime for us, well, I'll be Henry Kissinger. I'll be in the dock. I wonder if that isn't hanging over this whole business.
Well, it's interesting because, Samantha, I mean, the idea of putting the court in place is to actually deter those the actions that lead to genocide, isn't it?
It is. That is the intent. And I think Jack makes a very important point. There were many who, after the Pinochet decision, where Pinochet was obviously, there was a debate as to whether to extradite him to Spain, and the British found that they could extradite him, even though the crimes were committed in a completely different country against different citizens, because they were crimes against humanity. I think there was a great jubilation in the human rights community, and then a number of other countries have begun, as you indicated, throwing around indictments against Henry Kissinger, Ariel Sharon, other people, in the hopes of getting people who also were alleged to have committed war crimes into national courts. And I think in the human rights community, there was a sort of biting of the knuckles in fear that you would send a shudder effect into Washington and among policymakers that would end up torpedoing this structure, this new international criminal court, because policymakers would have a dog in the fight, where they might not have if it were just, you know, military officers who their courts could ultimately prosecute, you know, internally. So I think it's a very important point. But, you know, the fact of the matter is any country on the earth now can issue an indictment for Henry Kissinger. And indeed, you know, I think there was some talk of him having been served papers in Paris when he was last there, or somebody making an effort to serve him papers. I don't think he's traveling near as much because of the allegations of what he did in Cambodia and elsewhere. So I don't think the International Criminal Court is quote, the problem, as it were, for U.S. policymakers. I think it's the deeds in question, number one. And number two, the fact that universal jurisdiction, which is something that the other Jack didn't take terribly seriously, but the idea that there are certain crimes that are not only crimes against the victims, but they are crimes against humanity, and they can be prosecuted everywhere. And that's true of crimes against humanity and genocide.
800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Courtney is on the line.
Good evening.
Hi.
This is a fantastic discussion. I think you've laid out a lot of the issues. Samantha Power, thank you for mentioning the recent event in Afghanistan, which really kind of keys up our sense of the irony here and the hypocrisy of the double standard of Milosevic can go there and we can watch him being lambasted, but no American official should be held accountable. Not to mention Mozari Sharif, where we bombed a prison.
But Courtney, could you get to your question? Because we're going to run out of time in this
Here's
segment.
Here's the question. Europe. Let's talk about Europe. When will they finally get their hackles up enough to really throw some weight back on us? I mean, we're the pariah state on anti-ballistic missile treaty, the whole nine yards, the Kyoto Treaty. What's it going to take to get Europe mad enough to fight back?
I'm going to go to the next call, interestingly enough, because the next call up on my screen actually may take up your point. Paul is on the line.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Now, we've just been hearing from Courtney. He wants to know when Europe is going to get its hackles up. What do you think of that?
I think Europe should get its hackles up when it starts forking over as much money as we do to support the international community. I think your guest, Pamela, is...
Samantha.
Samantha is a representative of everything that is wrong with liberalism in this country. We have a policy of exceptionalism in the United States because we are an exceptional country, and people like her simply cannot accept it.
But when you say an exceptional country, I mean... Does that mean that the U.S. should conduct itself in the world in isolation?
We're sitting here having a discussion about whether the United States should submit itself to an international court for fear that the United States would engage in a policy of genocide. The United States does not engage in
genocide. It has nothing to worry about. Then it has absolutely nothing to worry about.
It has a lot to worry about because we have enough trouble with the people like you in this country who hate this country without...
Paul, I'm going to stop you right there because I know Samantha and I know that she doesn't hate the United States, but we do actually take an interest and a care in how America wields its power, as I'm sure you do. So I'm going to thank you for that call. I'm going to bring Jack into the conversation. We heard two points of view there. One was that America is exceptional and should submit in no way to any supranational organizations. And then the earlier call, which was, when will other countries finally stand up to the United States?
Yeah, when will other countries stand up? Well, you know, they've been doing a lot of that in their way. I mean, there's been a lot of transatlantic complaint. It's likely to grow. I just think that in a way, a point that Paul made is relevant, that the one reason we won't hear so much is, of course, we still pay for European defense. And the European welfare states are able to grow while our taxpayers fund that. So I think there's a limit to what the Europeans are going to complain about from us. But you know, the point that Paul raised, that we're an exceptional state, does this mean that that human nature is suspended here? Does this mean that we've never done terrible things? Does this mean that Lieutenant Callie didn't exist, that my lie didn't happen? You know, Americans are people, too, and they do bad things. And some of them, perhaps, would properly come under the jurisdiction of a court like this. This isn't just about, you know, we're part of humanity. I guess I go back to a point that Samantha was making. This is one human family here.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Ali is on the line.
Hi, can you hear me?
Just fine, Ali.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to ask a question, and that's in regards to how about acts of any government that may lead into genocide, such as making up weapons of destruction.
Using weapons of mass destruction. Okay, I'm going to throw that to Samantha, who is also a lawyer, and will know this rule, right? Does the use of weapons of mass destruction qualify as genocide?
The use of weapons of mass destruction, it would probably qualify as massive crimes against humanity if it was done systematically to wipe out civilians. Genocide just happens to be defined a little bit differently, where it has to be a systematic attempt to destroy a national, ethnic, or religious group as such, so where you're targeting the group. And weapons of mass destruction are so indiscriminate that the likelihood is they wouldn't be ethnically motivated, that it would be, you know, to take a territory or aimed at the United States. But conceivably, you could make a genocide case, but I think you'd be off the charts in terms of crimes against humanity as well. Could I just respond to the idea that I'm un-American and anti-patriotic
and
hate my country? I think it's the furthest thing from the truth. I actually am really quite terrified at the extent to which American unilateralism and exceptionalism is generating resentment around the world, and terrified about what the costs are going to be to American interests as well as values. And my book, which is on American responses to genocide in the 20th century, of which Bob Dole, a Republican, is the hero, perhaps, of the book, you could say, because he was the only political figure in the 20th century to force an American president to get involved in stopping genocide. But in this book, one of the things you see again and again is, if you allow these crimes, if you think you can build a wall around them, they're not our problem, we can't be the world's policemen, if you don't prosecute them after the fact, if you let the war criminals run amok, as they will if there is no international criminal court or any tribunals to prosecute them, it comes back to haunt Americans. Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurds in northern Iraq in 1988, killing more than 100,000 of them. We didn't pay attention to that at the time. Iran was the enemy in the neighborhood. His internal affairs were his business, very much like what Washington Jack was saying earlier, you know, sovereignty, sovereignty. Those chemical agents that he used against the Kurds, while we supported him as he was attacking the Kurds in that fashion, are the very chemical weapons we're now afraid that he's going to use against us. If we had actually had a mechanism in place to bring him to justice, to put pressure, working with our allies, to actually get him and his minions extradited to an international criminal body, we would be less frightened today about the welfare of Americans.
Samantha Power, thank you very much. The name of Samantha Power's book, by the way, is A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. And I commend it to you. Jack Spencer joined us earlier in the hour. He's defense national security policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Jack Beatty was with us, and he'll continue to be with us. Continue the conversation online. And in a moment, the making of a doctor. This is On Point. July 1st is changeover day at the nation's hospitals, and each year on this day, new medical school graduates begin their careers as doctors with shiny new stethoscopes in hands and probably a few butterflies in their stomachs. This year's crop of interns take their first steps as physicians. Hours are long, pay is low, hopes are high. And in this radio diary, Dr. Colleen O'Connor reflects on her first day at the hospital and the long road ahead.
The first day just legendarily has a lot of anxiety because there's really no way to be fully prepared to assume the role of doctor when you're a medical student. There's just a very difficult transition that just has to take place. And I think it's a real rite of passage for people to start and to just actually have patients that they actually have to be physician for instead of the student for. There's really no other profession, I think, like this that has a true apprenticeship period where you go from, you know, being a student to suddenly being in charge, being the doctor, being the one responsible for that patient. So it's an exciting time, but, you know, understandably a time full of anxiety and awkwardness and questions of one's confidence and, you know, how am I going to actually pull this off? I think that, you know, the hours are a huge predicament, and it's what most people think of when they think of being a resident, is being on call a lot. For me, I'm basically going to be on call every fourth night for an extended period of time, which means admitting patients that come in through the emergency room, spending a lot of time in the hospital, not necessarily being able to go home and see my family. I'm going to be eating a lot of cafeteria food. I'm going to be wearing a lot of scrubs and not really being able to function as a normal person. And there's a lot put upon you in terms of, you know, you can be doing everything from admitting a patient and ordering labs to, you know, chasing down old medical records from other hospitals, you know, to taking a patient to be catheterized when they've had a heart attack. So, I mean, it really runs the gamut, and it certainly is, you know, from the ridiculous to the sublime in terms of the level of things you have to do. But it's all part of learning how to become a doctor. What I hope my patients will think about me at the end of the day or after I've met them for the first time is that I'm someone that they felt comfortable with, that they feel that they could trust and get good answers from, that they respect me, that they look at me and say, she's a balanced person who makes sense and can see what my problem is and understands me, and is someone that I would go back to again. I think that the first time that the beeper goes off is probably for a lot of people one of the most anxiety-ridden times because, you know, the expectation is that you're going to have an answer to the questions being asked of you, and that's really overwhelming. Even if it's just a ridiculous question, you have no idea why you're getting paged. I also think the idea of being called doctor from the get-go, from having graduated from medical school, now you're going from being a medical student to a doctor, is a little bit ridiculous. It's almost as if you really need to earn it, and I think certainly going through 4 years of medical school, you've earned it. You've got that MD behind your name, but now to actually use it and be called it is something that's just going to be very unfamiliar, and I think for a long time I'm going to be looking over my shoulder wondering who they're talking to.
Well, my guess is she'll get used to it very quickly. Dr. Colleen O'Connor is a first-year resident in internal medicine at the Leahy Clinic in Burlington, Massachusetts, and a graduate of Tufts Medical School. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. This is WBUR.